There is a cultural result. When the hottest actors in Hollywood are making out with other guys, when the hottest actresses are claiming to be attracted to other girls, when tough guys on screen are portrayed as macho jerks, and heroes are portrayed as feminized, homosexual fantasies, those who back Judeo-Christian morality are in serious trouble. It's no wonder that in a 1996 poll, 62% of children aged 10 to 16 said that sex on TV shows and movies influences kids to have sex when they are too young. Here we stand, almost 40 years into the new era of filmmaking. We traded the old morality for a new, more permissive, more open, and more arbitrary ethic. Sexual activity and homosexuality in the movies gets more and more prominent with each passing year. By promoting the idea that anyone could be gay, Hollywood hopes to force acceptance of a homosexual lifestyle. By pushing warped views of sexual activity into the mainstream of pop culture, kids begin experimenting with their sexuality at earlier and earlier ages. In the early preteen or teenage years, sexuality is a new phenomenon, and as such, tends to be rather undirected. By forcing homosexuality onto the table and claiming equal legitimacy with heterosexuality, kids are forced to confront their sexuality before they have had a chance to come to grips with it. The Hays Code stated, "When right standards are consistently presented, the motion picture exercises the most powerful influences. It builds character, develops right ideals, inculcates correct principles, and all this in attractive story form. If motion pictures consistently hold up for admiration high types of characters and present stories that will affect lives for the better, they can become the most powerful force for the improvement of mankind." When, as a society, we decided that standards in movies no longer mattered, we sacrificed something great, the popular requirement that filmmakers strive to enrich society and uphold traditions of American morality. We sacrificed the idea that there's any kind of responsibility by our cultural authorities to think about the effect of their work, not just cater to the lowest common denominator. It's a sad commentary that we sold that goal for a few feet of dirty film. Chapter 10. The Lotion Picture Industry. Jim Haynes and Germaine Greer had just published the first issue of a newspaper that all London was talking about. It was called Suck. Jim Haynes went on with a discourse about the aims of Suck. To put it in a few words, the aim was sexual liberation, the liberation of the spirit of man. If you were listening to this speech and had read Suck, or even if you hadn't, you were likely to be watching Jim Haynes' face for the beginnings of a campy grin, a smirk, a wink, a roll of the eyeballs, something to indicate that he was just having his little joke. But it soon became clear that he was one of those people who exist on a plane quite beyond irony. Whatever it had been for him once, sex had now become a religion, and he had developed a theology in which the orgasm had become a form of spiritual ecstasy. Tom Wolfe, New York Magazine, August 23, 1976. He could have been the boy next door. Smart, handsome, outgoing, Ted Bundy was the picture of a man on the way up. But Bundy was no ordinary young man on the make. He was a serial killer, and he murdered dozens of young women, sexually assaulting many of them as well. Dr. James Dobson interviewed Bundy just hours before his execution. The man with nothing to lose opened his dark soul before Dobson. The day after Bundy was electrocuted, Dobson released the tape of his talk with the mass murderer. The transcript is chilling, and the insight of the killer is far too matter-of-fact to be ignored. Bundy insisted that his home life in early childhood was normal. "That's part of the tragedy of this whole situation," he explained, "because I grew up in a wonderful home with two dedicated and loving parents. As one of five brothers and sisters, a home where we as children were the focus of my parents' lives, where we regularly attended church, two Christian parents who did not drink, they did not smoke, there was no gambling, no physical abuse, no fighting in the home. So when did the young man with a future become a man with brutal rape and murder on his mind? This is the message I want to get across," he said, "that as a young boy, I encountered outside the home again, in the local grocery store, in a local drug store, the softcore pornography that people called softcore. And from time to time, we would come across pornographic books of a harder nature than, of a more graphic, explicit nature than we would encounter at the local grocery store. And this also included such things as detective magazines. Bundy described the pornography he encountered. "This is something I think I want to emphasize, is that the most damaging kinds of pornography, and again, I'm talking from personal experience, are those that involve violence and sexual violence. Because the wedding of those two forces, as I know only too well, brings out the hatred that is just too terrible to describe. Like most addicts, after a certain point, the dosage needs to be raised in order to achieve the same effect. When the effect of hardcore porn is minimized, the addict needs to do more to get the same thrill. And when that thrill can no longer be attained from paper filth, the addict must move on to higher forms of perversion. It happened in stages, gradually," Bundy related. "My experience with pornography generally, but with pornography that deals on a violent level with sexuality, is once you become addicted to it, and I look at this as a kind of addiction like other kinds of addiction, I would keep looking for more potent, more explicit, more graphic kinds of material. Until you reach a point where the pornography only goes so far, you reach that jumping off point where you begin to wonder if maybe actually doing it would give you that which is beyond just reading it, or looking at it." And then Bundy snapped. "It's a very difficult thing to describe, the sensation of reaching that point where I knew that something had, say, snapped." Bundy described it as a compulsion, a building up of this destructive energy. What alcohol did in conjunction with exposure to pornography is alcohol reduced my inhibitions. At the same time, the fantasy life that was fueled by pornography eroded them further. So Ted Bundy raped and murdered. Other sources, particularly porn industry sources, would later question whether indeed Bundy had been a boy-next-door type turned maniacal killer. Al Goldstein, a contributing editor for Penthouse Magazine and publisher of Screw, wrote a piece for the Los Angeles Times in which he claimed that the anti-porn cause would lead to the repeal of the First Amendment. "The implicit message of the Dobson-Bundy interview is that we should censor adult material. But censorship, once embarked on, has a way of growing out of control. Look to Iran or the Soviet Union to see about that." Playboy repeatedly attempted to blame Bundy's evil on sexual repression rather than sexual excess. A piece by anti-repression crusader Philip Nobile, co-author of The United States of America versus Sex, appeared in the July 1989 issue of Playboy. Nobile quotes Mies Commission member Dr. Park Dietz, praising the softcore Playboy erotica as among the healthiest sexual images in America.
In July 1990, Playboy reiterated its pro-porn propaganda in an interview with Dr. John Money of Johns Hopkins University School of Medicine.
The interview reads like a direct transcript of Tom Wolfe's conversation with Jim Haynes. "In the 60s, Money says, America experienced what the media called a sexual revolution. However, if we wanted to be accurate, we would call it a reformation. Like all reformations, it was spontaneous rather than planned. Historically, all reformations are followed by a backlash, a counter-reformation. We are currently in a sexual counter-reformation." Money continued. "Essentially, some people are taking everything that is sex positive and labeling it sex negative. Today's witch hunt goes after women's liberation, gay liberation, sex education, contraception, teenage pregnancy, abortion, and pornography. When you criminalize pornography, you criminalize sex." According to Money, not only is pornography not immoral, pornography actually prevents sex crimes. Noting that he sees many positive benefits of pornography, Money stated, "I have one patient who, when he is exposed to normal erotic images such as you find in Playboy, has normal sexual fantasies. In the absence of healthy erotica, he has sadistic, brutal fantasies about bondage, rape, and death." Nods the interviewer. "Close a newsstand, create a killer." No wonder Hugh Hefner expressly requested that Playboy interview Dr. Money. The hard, cold truth of the matter is that pornography is addictive.
It's addictive because the male mind is hardwired to crave sexual imagery.
Where pornography differs from checking out a woman is the extent shown. Softcore pornography and cheesecake photos are all less dangerous by degrees than harder stuff. And the Ted Bundy-like progression from softcore to hardcore to obscenely violent porn to murder is extremely rare. All the same, the idea that sex fiends become sex fiends because of lack of sexual knowledge or exposure to sex is a self-serving lie. A Los Angeles Police Department study spanning 10 years found that pornography was a factor in 62% of child molestation cases. An FBI study of serial killers found that 81% reported hardcore porn to be their highest sexual interest. As Dr. Dobson explains, you don't have to be a psychopath to become desensitized to violence and harm to other people. You can show statistically that exposing young boys to certain kinds of sexual experience in early adolescence produces a rather high probability of sexual problems later on. Dr. Kelly Hollowell, founder of Science Ministries Incorporated, explains that there is a biological predilection toward pornography. Once the switch is turned too many times, it's tough to turn off. Writes Hollowell, simply said, the more pornography is viewed, the more distorted one's views of sex become. This is called desensitization. For example, when one study group was exposed to as little as 5 hours of nonviolent pornography, they began to think pornography was not offensive, and that rapists deserved milder punishments. They also became more callous and negative toward women, and developed an appetite for more deviant or violent types of pornography. Researchers now link this change in behavior to the startling discovery that when people indulge in pornography, they release powerful chemicals that actually change the structure of the brain and body, creating a physical and chemical addiction.
This addiction is so powerful, it is being likened to cocaine, alcohol, and heroin.
And like any drug addiction, once hooked, addicts need harder and more perverse images to achieve the same high. Even in the most innocent cases, pornography is still, in Dr. Dobson's words, damnable. It implicitly teaches men, and I speak here almost exclusively about men, because the market for porn is overwhelmingly male, that women have no dignity. The feminists are right when they say that pornography debases women. It provides a false standard for female sexuality, because it teaches that women are as sexually driven as men. It provides a false standard for female beauty, because normal women don't have boob jobs and liposuction, unless you're in Los Angeles. It's no wonder, as Professor James B. Weaver of Virginia Tech explains, that the use of pornography leads to sexual callousness, the erosion of family values, and diminished sexual satisfaction. And the sexual imagery doesn't simply dissipate once men stop looking at it. It sticks in their memory. As Marianne Layden, co-director of the Sexual Trauma and Psychopathology Program at the University of Pennsylvania, testified before Congress, pornography is the most concerning thing to psychological health that I know of existing today. There is a connection between mainstream porn and kiddie porn as well. Much of what passes for softcore pornography is schoolgirl porn, passing models off as high school cheerleaders, ready for some action. Vincent Golfin of the Syracuse Post-Standard explains, one of the students, I won't use her name, was shown fully clothed with an armful of books leaning against a tree, with the college's Ivy League-looking Hall of Languages in the background. Next to that shot was a photo of the same girl wearing only tennis shoes, sitting legs wide open in what looked like a dorm room. In one photo, the young woman looked like a Bobby Soxer. Virginal, innocent. Is that reality? In the nude photo, she sat brazenly, hair swept back, looking too worldly. Is that reality? Maybe that's why Bundy said the person hooked on pornography loses grip on reality. Is it any wonder that virgin slut characters like Britney Spears are the most downloaded figures on the internet? Yet we're told that to pass laws against porn means infringing upon basic American freedoms. The Supreme Court has repeatedly ruled against internet pornography laws. The ACLU routinely stands with the pornographers in their fight against morality, under the guise of free speech, of course. Labeling obscenity a right that the Founding Fathers sought to protect is, in and of itself, an obscenity. In the end, it's also indescribably selfish. One of the most sickening aspects of pornography is its narcissism. A narcissism so deep and broad that it approaches theology of the self. Because looking at naked people in the sexual act is really about getting your rocks off. It's about leaving the real world and entering a sick fantasy world where everything revolves around the penis, the vagina, the breasts, and the anus. And all of those sexual organs revolve around you. As Tom Wolfe puts it, it is merely an example of how people in even the most secular manifestation of the me decade, freelance, spread'em, ziggy-zig rutting, are likely to go through the usual states. Let's talk about me. Let's find the real me. Let's get rid of all the hypocrisies and impediments and false modesties that obscure the real me. Ah, at the apex of my soul is a spark of the divine, which I perceive in the pure moment of ecstasy, which your textbooks call the orgasm, but which I know to be heaven. The Biz. Jazz McKay is a conservative libertarian talk show host from Fresno, California. His show, broadcast from 6 to 9 p.m. every weeknight on 580 a.m., covers politics and pop culture. I met Jazz after he invited me on his show to promote my first book. We've been friends ever since, and I participate in his radio program each Thursday night and discuss the issues of the day. Jazz is an interesting fellow. A staunch fiscal conservative, a foreign policy hawk, and a social libertarian. He's been in radio all his life, but for a few years, he had a side career as well. Jazz started as a DJ for the gentleman's club chain Deja Vu, and worked his way up to management of several of the Midwest clubs. Deja Vu has dozens of outlets around the country. They're famous for their dancing strippers and their no-alcohol policy. Deja Vu is known in the porn community for its responsible business practices. In the rest of the community, of course, they're known only for their porn. The front page of their website carries only a bikini-clad blonde and a disclaimer. The materials which are available within this site may include graphic visual depictions and descriptions of nudity and sexual activity, and should not be accessed by anyone who is younger than 18 years old, or who does not wish to be exposed to such materials. It also includes a link away from the site, which directs you to a search engine. Jazz is no whistleblower. He enjoyed working at Deja Vu. It was a very professional organization. When they started, they made most of their money off of book and tape sales and sex toys. Now, most of their business is made in the Gentleman's Club. A typical Deja Vu has three sections. There's the real money-making section, the dancers with the stage and all that. There's the porn shop, and then there's the booths, where the customers go in, put some money in the slot, the curtain goes up, and they get a private show. According to Jazz, he once took a group of Christian protesters through one of his clubs, after first telling the girls to tone down the raunchy stuff, and they gave it a clean bill of health. His typical ploy with community protesters was to kill them with kindness, bringing them coffee in the snow, bringing out the girls to meet the protesters. It worked like a charm, he told me. Jazz is an open porn advocate. There's nothing wrong with adult entertainment. Look, you and I, we believe that there's something more to sex than just the physical act. There's emotion there too. But the physical isn't bad either. It may not be something you are into, but others are, and I believe it's harmless. There have been countless studies done, and I don't know of any that can prove any harm to anyone. And let me tell you, sexual experimentation can really be a good thing. My first marriage, my wife and I were swingers. The first time we swung, we took home this guy named John my wife had known most of her life. It was a fantasy my wife wanted. I loved her, I wanted to give her that fantasy, so I said okay to it. It was one of the most moving nights of my life. After the two of us had pleasured her several times, I turned over to go to sleep. I wasn't really out yet, but they thought I was. I heard John tell my wife, "I've always loved you." And then, and this still makes me cry, she said to him, "I love you too, but I'm in love with Jazz. Now go to sleep." When I ask him why he broke up with his wife, Jazz tells me that's a long story. He had had an affair several years after the swinging days had ended. I asked Jazz whether he thought the porn and swinging led to the marriage's breakup. Not in the least. It was because of a long series of events that had absolutely nothing to do with the swinging or porn. Hell, porn wasn't even something either of us watched in those days, he says. I explain that, from a Jewish perspective, sex within the confines of marriage should still have an intensely spiritual element. If a man is even thinking of another woman, he is forbidden from sleeping with his wife. The respect for the woman is tremendous, and the idea of opening a marriage to the slings and arrows of an oversexed society, let alone to a third party, is abhorrent. Jazz disagrees. Porn has never once had any negative effects on any of my relationships, Jazz states. A porn connoisseur, Jazz owns over 300 vintage porn videos, from the bad old days of one-camera, stationary shots, to slick, thinly woven porn movies, where there'll be a group of guys staring at two girls making out on a beach and devise a way to get in on the action. Jazz made his own low-budget amateur porn flicks for a while in the late 1980s. I'd ask the girls from the club to come to my house. I'd pay them $50 to do a solo act, or $100 each for girl-on-girl action. He also claims to be one of the first people to come up with the idea of using regular people to make porn. Real people, not professional actors or actresses. I submitted the idea to some people in the business, but they basically said thanks but no thanks. Then a few months later, the amateur adult film becomes a huge part of the adult industry. Isn't porn exploitative of women? That's feminist bull-s, he growls. These women are making a living for doing something they enjoy. And men and women are watching something they enjoy. What's the problem? Look, this whole exploitation thing is garbage. Of the millions of adult movie rentals every year, studies show most were watched by two people. 47% of these rentals are made by women in couples or women alone. The overall stat shows that 500 million videos are rented each year. If 47% are rented by couples, that means nearly 250 million are being rented by women or couples. Well, Reagan's 1984 election was considered to be a landslide with 54 million votes. And these figures don't include adult video sales, cable TV viewings, internet sales, or adult theater attendance. Jazz dismisses the idea that a skewed vision of male patriarchy plays a negative role in pornography. It's interesting to note that the feminist movement has become increasingly schizophrenic on this issue. For some, the porn industry is pure exploitation. For others, the newly found women for porn fad is merely female sexuality leaping out of the closet. I'm of the mind that porn is exploitative for different reasons. Some girls unify the two views, as does Sarah, a former University of Washington student. Sarah says that if a man thought less of her for stripping, he'd be a real asshole. Yet she admits that I'm always in a position of feeling objectified. Why shouldn't I get paid for it? Porn says women are the embodiment of sex, but the best relationships are supposed to be about more than sex. As Max, Sarah's University of Washington boyfriend, told the campus newspaper, there's a tension between my appreciation of watching Sarah's naked cavorting and the dehumanizing aspect. Porn degrades the men who view it and the women who allow themselves to be degraded by it. I ask Jazz what he thinks of youngsters being exposed to sexual images. I don't think it's incredibly damaging for young people to see adult material, within reason, of course. I first saw Playboy magazine, which I do not consider porn, by the way, at 10 years old, and it didn't screw me up. Look, seeing images you're already imagining isn't damaging, is it? For instance, you can't tell me, not you or any other straight guy, that you don't dream of having two women in bed at the same time. So what's wrong with seeing that happen? But in any case, porn isn't being marketed to kids, and I'll say this, that the internet is pretty loose, which needs more policing. What are the girls like? I ask. Why do they get into the business? Most of them are pretty typical girls. At one time in the 70s, they used to be aspiring actresses who couldn't make it in the legit film business, but now they're drawn by the allure of the cash. As a stripper, they walk into the club, get naked, and get $500 the first night. But that's also part of the problem. With all that expendable cash, lots of young strippers get into drugs. When I was managing the clubs, I would toss a girl at the first sign of drug use. I ask what seems to me to be one of the more important questions. What do these girls think about sex? If they're willing to sell their bodies and souls for some easy money, what does making love really mean to them? It's a job, with the added benefit of living out a fantasy of making men take on the role of the subservient. It's nothing deeper than that, Jazz explains. But that's the life of the stripper. Nothing whatsoever to do with the porn star. Porn actors are another animal. Like apples and oranges, they are nowhere near the same. The truth be told, porn actors and actresses are doing what they love and earning a paycheck, paying taxes, etc. They are public fornicators, make no mistake about it. Period. Paragraph. End of story. And who are you, or anyone for that matter, to pass judgment on them? You don't know them or the reasons why they do what they do. As I said, I'm no mind reader, so I can't answer for them. But I will say they are enjoying their jobs. As I would too, if I could do it. This isn't any surprise to me by this point in the conversation. After all, I've just been informed that these talented men and women are all about seeing on cue. The porn industry is skewing younger and younger. It's the college-aged who are being targeted by the porn industry and used by it. Girls Gone Wild is a symptom of a larger disease. At Indiana University, a film crew from the California-based Shane Enterprises taped several students engaging in sex acts with porn actresses. Between 20 and 30 students signed releases to appear in the film, and according to Shane Enterprises, university students invited the company there to film. The artistic masterpiece, Shane's World No. 32, Campus Invasion. Larry Flint went so far as to start a whole magazine, Barely Legal, devoted to photographing girls just over 18. One click into the site, the viewer receives titillating pictures of teenagers in lesbian poses with the captions, "From the homeroom to the bedroom, these young cuties are eager to please and try everything. Sweet and cute, but not innocent," and "Barely 18 and ready for some action." The viewer also gets an unending stream of pop-up ads leading to various teenage porn sites. Some of the girls in the pop-ups don't look more than 16, and even if they're overage, they're certainly not telling viewers to lay off the youngsters. Certainly the porn industry is geared more toward college students these days, Jazz says. Poor old fat, ugly Ron Jeremy wouldn't last 10 minutes in today's porn industry. When an actor hits 40, he's through, and that's if he's lucky. The strippers and actors are all in their early 20s. The Britney Spears phenomenon came about because of her Catholic schoolgirl, faux virgin routine. And though Jazz and other industry spokesmen maintain that no underage girls slip through the cracks, even if these girls aren't underage, they pose as if they were. Aren't there guys looking at 15 and 16-year-old girls as sex objects now? Yeah, I guess it happens, Jazz admits. I'm no pervert, but I do date younger women, all of legal age, by the way. I feel I have to say that because your readers may misconstrue my statements. One friend of mine is Hyapatia Lee, who is today in her mid-40s. As I understand her story, she started at the age of 16 or 17. She has controlled her entire career, like the vast majority of adult film stars, and today is retired with a huge bank account, and no desire to suck off the government tit of welfare or Medicare.
I ask him whether the porn honchos are driven by profit or by something deeper.
I'd say it's 90% profit, he explains, but for many of them, the cause goes along with it. They have to justify themselves somehow. If you're a prude or a moralist, this ain't your business. Or maybe it is, but you just don't know it yet. The net. The internet is easily the most prolific porn producer in the world, even if the quality of the porn is low class, in Jazz's words. Even as a porn proponent, he admits that the internet porn industry needs more regulation. As of 2002,
the National Research Council reported that there were 400,000 sexually explicit websites on the net.
N2H2, a Seattle-based software company, reports far more, 1.3 million, 1,800% more than in 1998. The Internet Filter Review places the number at 4.2 million websites, encompassing 372 million web pages, constituting 12% of the total number of websites on the Internet. Type in the term porn on Google.com, and you'll get a nearly infinite number of 149 million hits. Easy misspelling of search terms often leads straight to porn. If you type teen into a search engine, you'll get teen magazines. If you type T-E-E-N, you'll get porn. Type in Hun, as in Attila the, and you'll likely get thehun.com, a yellow pages for porn. More famously, if you type whitehouse.gov into your search engine, you'll get the White House. Type in whitehouse.com, however, and you'll get a porn site. Online porn is certainly a moneymaker. The National Research Council report stated that cyber porn garners over $1 billion per year and could soon grow to $5 billion. The porn industry in general takes in $57 billion worldwide and $12 billion in the United States per year, more than all the combined revenues of pro football, basketball, and baseball franchises, as well as the combined revenues of ABC, CBS, and NBC. Kiddie porn generates $3 billion each year. There are at least 100,000 child pornography websites available on the Internet. Also available, incestuous porn, bestial porn, and with extreme commonness, virgin porn, for those guys who like to pretend that their fetish girls really haven't done anything before taping a hardcore sex video. Schoolgirl porn is especially typical, from first-time lesbian schoolgirls to orgy schoolgirl porn. The college roommates idea is also big. Lesbian porn between co-eds is insanely popular. The idea that the porn industry doesn't push men to look at 15 to 18-year-old girls as sex objects is ridiculous. Unfortunately, the Internet isn't just the most prolific porn producer. It's also the easiest place to find porn. Registering for nearly anything on the net guarantees that you'll have porn spam in your email box, including everything from want a bigger penis to Asian schoolgirl fun. There are 2.8 billion daily pornography emails circulating around the Internet, 8% of the total number of daily emails. Here's the newest weapon, Instant Messenger, IM. You can be sitting online on AOL, MSN, or another IM service, when suddenly you receive an instant message from some gal asking you to check out her webcam, a camera set up to film people, often in compromising positions. With email spam under attack, the IM spamming, also known as spimming, is the new wave. As PC World reported, the number of IM spam messages will triple in the year 2004, from 400 million to 1.2 billion, according to the research firm The Radicati Group. IM spammers are developing sophisticated software which automatically sends messages, which are mainly touting pornography, to millions of users, and which can automatically change screen names when the user blocks an IM attempt. Think your child is safe from online porn if you don't give him a credit card? Try again. Hardcore porn pictures are available all over the Internet, and children don't even have to pretend to be 18 to see them. Over 70% of porn sites offer free images and stories to draw people into the site, and there are any number of search engines that will help kids find these pictures. If you spend any amount of time on the Internet, it's difficult not to find yourself in the midst of a hardcore porn site, and if you do, you can't easily leave. A practice called mousetrapping means that by clicking out of the site, you'll be hit with a virtually endless series of pop-up ads for other porn sites. And the only way to stop the flood of pornography is to shut the window or turn off the web browser. More and more people, specifically men, 72% of visitors to porn sites are male, are being drawn into the world of web porn. Whereas the non-internet porno man would have to go into the darkened section of his local video store or stroll to his nearest newsstand to browse the blacked-out magazine section, it's oh so easy to simply click on a web link. All it takes to stash the porn is a quick minimization click. You can do it from work or from home, and they do. According to 2003 IFR statistics, there are 72 million worldwide visitors to porn websites annually. 20% of men admit to accessing porn at their place of employment. 40 million U.S. adults regularly visit porn sites. 10% of adults admitted to internet sexual addiction. Most shockingly, religious communities have been hard hit by the problem of internet porn. A full 53% of Promise Keeper men stated that they had viewed porn in the last week, and 47% of Christians said pornography was a major problem in their home. In a 2003 poll, 34% of Today's Christian Woman's online newsletter readers admitted to intentionally accessing internet porn. A Zogby International poll conducted for Focus on the Family in 2000 showed that 25.9% of American men and 16.7% of American women said that it was either very or somewhat likely they could find sexual fulfillment online. 18.68% of Christians said the same thing. A survey by Christianity Today magazine found that 37% of pastors admit to struggling with pornography. Internet porn doesn't only affect adults. Kids are the hardest hit by the internet porn hurricane. The average age of first internet exposure to pornography stands at 11 years old. The largest consumers of internet porn are kids aged 12 to 17. The statistics are incredible. 80% of 15 to 17-year-olds report having had multiple exposures to hardcore porn, and 90% of 8 to 16-year-olds report having viewed porn online, most while doing their homework. Kids are victims of sexual aggression online as well. Nearly 24 million children aged 10 to 17 were online regularly in 1999. 1 in 4 had an unwanted exposure to pictures of naked people or people having sex in that year. 71% of those kids experiencing unwanted exposure found it while surfing the web, and 28% received it while opening email or clicking on links in email or IMs. Only 17% of incidents occurred wherein the youth knew he or she was entering a porno site. A full 89% of sexual solicitations toward youths are made in chat rooms. 20% of youths have received sexual solicitations. 1 in 33 children aged 10 to 17 received an aggressive sexual solicitation. A solicitor who asked to meet them somewhere called them on the telephone or sent them regular mail, money, or gifts. 1 in 17 was threatened or harassed. Many of these sexual solicitations were propositions for cybersex, wherein participants described various sex acts, often while masturbating. The National Center for Missing and Exploited Children stated in a June 2000 report that in the year 1999, there were at least 785 traveler cases where a child or adult traveled to physically meet with someone he or she had first encountered on the internet. The kids aren't telling their parents either. Only a quarter of youths who encountered a sexual solicitation or approach told a parent, and only 40% of those who experienced an unwanted exposure to sexual material informed a parent. Online porn is the direst threat to moral attitudes toward sex today. Availability has thrust perversion and depravity onto computer screens around the country free of charge, and those weak enough to click once may end up refreshing their screens rather often. As Dr. Carrie Hollowell puts it, what was once a rather isolated problem has become a widespread crisis based on three factors uniquely related to internet use: accessibility, affordability, and anonymity. The cheap and easy porn found online means setting unattainable standards for real-life sex. It means devaluing sex to a merely physical act. As Dr. Ursula Hoffman, a Manhattan-based sex therapist, told NewYorkMetro.com, it's so accessible. And now, with things like streaming video and webcams, guys are getting sucked into a compulsive behavior. What's most regrettable is that it can really affect relationships with women. I've seen some young men lately who can't get aroused with women, but have no problem interacting with the internet. I think a big danger is that young men who are constantly exposed to these fake, always willing women start to have unreal expectations from real women, which makes them phobic about relationships. Without any leadership or restriction by society, the situation spirals ever downward, with no end in sight. Porn in the public square. Porn has hit the mainstream and hit it big. In 1953, Hugh Hefner sprung onto the scene with Playboy and a nude Marilyn Monroe centerfold. In the words of Professor Jeffrey P. Morin of the University of Kansas, more literary and mainstream than cheap girly magazines, more overtly sexual than its ancestor, Esquire magazine, Playboy sprang from Hefner's conviction that millions of American men, at least, were ready for a more public expression of sexuality.
Hefner's creation was to have the same ripple effect as Alfred Kinsey's books in shifting public discussion toward greater sexual frankness.
Even as the public culture grew more overtly sexual, the moral unity among family sociologists, family life educators, sex educators, and other authorities on sex was beginning to crumble. Now, of course, Hefner is hailed as an influential mainstream figure. The Washington Post calls Hefner an icon. Anderson Cooper of CNN lauds Hefner as the granddaddy of all playboys, the 77-year-old who still puts the play in player. He's a champion of free speech, according to the New York Post, a sexual pioneer, according to the Boston Herald. Hef is so mainstream that in 2003, he even did a raunchy commercial for burger chain Carl's Jr. The aging Hefner, bearing a strong resemblance to the crypt keeper in silk pajamas, looks directly into the camera and tells the audience, "People always ask me, 'Hey Hef, do you have favorites?' I tell them, 'No, it's not about that.'" Three young hotties then explain Hefner's philosophy. "He can have anything he wants. I don't know how he makes the choice," says Sido Beef One. "I feel for Hef, it's so hard to choose," avers Sido Beef 2. "I don't know how he does it," marvels Sido Beef 3. Cut back to Hefner. "I love them all. It just depends on what I'm in the mood for." The commercial then pictures Hefner biting into a burger while the announcer intones, "Because some guys don't like the same thing night after night." The president and CEO of Carl's Jr., parent company CKE, Andy Puzder, justified the Hefner commercial to shareholders, writing, "Who better to deliver the message of variety than Hugh Hefner? We're appealing to an audience of young, hungry guys who expect a quality product, but want to have something different from time to time. As a pop icon, Hefner appeals to our target audience and credibly communicates our message of variety." Fellow porn enthusiasts like Larry Flint have also been enshrined in the popular culture. Flint, who ran for California governor during the Gray Davis recall, was also deified by Hollywood in The People vs. Larry Flint. Woody Harrelson played the porn magnate, a fun-loving, free-speech-pushing dude. It's no wonder that Jazz cites Flint as one of his personal heroes. The court system has ensured that people like Flint and Hefner are seen not as dirty old men, but as purveyors of free speech, implying that our founders laid down life, liberty, and property for the sake of naked pictures. The latest decision to support the pornographers concerned internet porn.
In Ashcroft versus American Civil Liberties Union,
where porn is in danger, the ACLU is just a phone call away. The Supreme Court ruled on June 29, 2004, that a law created to punish pornographers who push their wares to web-surfing children is probably unconstitutional. The Child Online Protection Act was passed in 1998, signed by President Clinton, and backed by the Bush administration. It would have authorized fines of up to $50,000 for the crime of placing material harmful to minors within the easy reach of children on the internet, and also would have required adults to use access codes and/or other registration means in order to see porn online. A 5-4 court decision upheld a lower court decision declaring the law a violation of the First Amendment. Justice Department officials derided the decision as a step in the wrong direction, but ACLU lawyers were happy as could be. As Ann Beeson, one of those righteous attorneys, told the Associated Press, "We're very pleased with the decision. The status quo is still with us, and the court made it safe for artists, sex educators, and web publishers to communicate with adults without risking jail time." A whole new generation of porn icons is on the way up. In 2004, widely known, yes, that includes the biblical sense, porn star Jenna Jameson put out her memoir advice book, How to Make Love Like a Porn Star. It immediately slept its way to the top of the bestseller lists. The Los Angeles Times characterized Jameson as an advocate for feminist ideals, explaining, "Conventional forms of self-improvement will never catch on with some people, a fact that troubles many feminists, and this porn diva wants to remind them of it." Publishers Weekly described the 577-page ode to porn as brimming with wit, noting, "The book is dedicated to Onan. 50 years ago, masturbation was taboo. Nowadays, mention masturbation and receive literary praise for your wit." As Jameson's website touts, Jenna Jameson has made the transition from adult star to mainstream personality.
Revolver magazine chose her as the 2003 Girl of the Year.
Recently, the Fox News networks carried three separate programs profiling Jenna in a space of 4 days. And Entertainment Tonight featured her in three back-to-back segments within a week's time. Jameson represents a new wave of porn hitting the bookshelves disguised as mainstream literature. In fall 2004 alone, the following titles had entered or were scheduled to enter bookstores across the country. XXX, 30 Porn Star Portraits, with introduction by Gore Vidal. The Intimate History of the Orgasm. Has the orgasm evolved over time? Pick up this book to find out. Star, The Fascinating Life of Pamela Anderson's Breasts, as well as a history of prostitution and one of the porno film industry. As even the lusty, heavy-breathing New York Times was forced to note, a wave of confessionals and self-help guides written by current or former stars of pornographic films is flooding bookstores this year, accompanied by erotic novels, racy sexual instruction guides, histories of sexual particulars, and photographic treatments of the world of pornography. Rarely have such books been as prominently positioned as some of the current crop, which have been elbowing their way onto display tables at the front of the major chain bookstores. Generation Porn. Porn serves to desensitize, to rev up the sexual instinct for no real purpose, to separate sex from love and spirituality. There's absolutely nothing spiritual or loving about logging on to JennaJameson.com and downloading videos of Jameson's cum shots. And for today's generation, porn has become just another perfectly acceptable portion of the public square. So where is all the condemnation? Many of those on the side of traditional morality ignore the problem of porn, hoping that it will go away. We let those who degrade and destroy the concept of spirituality within sexual relationships win. Unless we're willing to throw away our computers, televisions, and library cards for the sake of raising children in a safe and healthy environment, we can't afford to let the porn pushers win. As Professor James B. Weaver of Virginia Tech told a Senate subcommittee, we're so afraid to talk about sex in our society that we really give carte blanche to the people who are producing this kind of material. Others are simply afraid of frank talk, not about sex, but about morality in general. Morality is passé in today's society. Even if you oppose pornography, you're not supposed to take a stand against it. As Paige Messick, a 24-year-old Harvard law student, explained, there are plenty of things about pornography that make me uncomfortable, but I would be much more uncomfortable with those things being prohibited. Standing up for morality means facing loud derision, especially for children of the porn generation. Those of my age group may hold a quiet admiration for the sexually moral among us, but it's hidden beneath a facade of cynicism. We grew up in an age of Hugh Hefners and Jenna Jamesons, who no longer have to fight the moral establishment, but are instead hailed as heroes. We grew up in an age where acquiring pornographic material doesn't involve anything more strenuous than a few keystrokes at your laptop. We've been told there's nothing wrong with homosexuality and premarital sex, so what's so bad about checking out a few dirty pictures? Or visiting the local strip club? Or even signing a release to appear in the new Girls Gone Wild Mardi Gras video. Our parents' generation smoked grass and listened to psychedelic rock while making love, not war. We're not doing anything nearly that drastic. We're only watching two girls get it on. So what's the problem? As Amber Madison, formerly of Tufts University, and star of The Real Cancun explained in her Sex and the City style column, I've come to the conclusion that maybe porn isn't that bad after all. Nudie flicks may not be your thing, they're not mine either, but they're also not the downfall of healthy sexual relations. Hugh Hefner would agree. Ted Bundy wouldn't. Neither would his victims. Chapter 11. Taking a Stand. No period of history has ever been great, or ever can be, that does not act on some sort of high idealistic motives, and idealism in our time has been shoved aside, and we are paying the penalty for it. Alfred North Whitehead. After looking at the social breakdown of the porn generation, we are left to wonder, where does America go from here? Reversing the tide of our live-and-let-live culture won't be easy. I know. I'm 21 years old, a heterosexual, red-blooded American male, a graduate of University of California at Los Angeles, a student at Harvard Law School, a nationally syndicated columnist, a best-selling author, and a virgin. And I'm proud of it. I am proud of my choice, a decision that the amoral political left ridicules and cannot understand. I'm not a virgin for lack of easy girls. In college, they aren't hard to find. I'm not a virgin because I lack a sex drive either. I'm a virgin because according to Jewish law, halacha, men and women must remain virgins until marriage. The amoral left and our oversexed culture cannot comprehend abstinence as a choice. If you are a post-teenage virgin in the porn generation, you're weird at least, and probably demented. There's a high probability that you're deformed, either mentally or physically, because, dude, you couldn't get any. Virginity is a barrier to knowledge, according to the sexual activity advocates, and only those who are sexually active are bestowed with ultimate wisdom, which is, of course, why gigolos and prostitutes are among civilization's leading thinkers. Because of my vocal advocacy of abstinence until marriage, I've been reviled by leftists and labeled the Virgin Ben. The internet is riddled with writing like this. In Ben's case, it is helpful to remember that some people choose celibacy, while others have it thrust upon them. Poor Ben. He no more chose abstinence than Clarence Thomas chose to be black. The Virgin Ben also apparently has never had a really great Saturday night. The Virgin Ben judges college-age fornicators. Who could have guessed this was coming? The Virgin Ben, indeed. This guy's interview so completely reeks of repression that I almost feel violated having read it, like I stepped into someone else's wet dream. It's freaking eerie, man. You know, I'm starting to feel sorry for this kid. I look into his future and I can see that not once is he ever going to get to have really good, hot, sweaty sex with Miss Scarlet in the parlor with a bottle of lube. That kind of sex may not approach godliness, but for a few brief moments and a lifetime of memories, it sure feels like it. Whether these internet denizens recognize it or not, they are representative of a larger anti-virtue demographic. My own experience is representative of what many members of the porn generation endure in their own high schools and on their college campuses every day. We're forced to undergo this experience because, in the twisted view of the sex-obsessed moral relativists, abstinence before marriage is a demented way of life, and virginity itself is seen as some sort of strange plague. In a world where deviance is praised, purity is the new sin. So the question of where we go from here, for those who care about their future, the future of their children, and the future of our country, becomes a simple one to answer. We must recognize how bad things have truly become, and act in response to it. In order to prevent the porn generation from plunging into the cultural abyss, we need to strengthen ourselves, our families, and our children. Parents must stop and pay attention to what's going on in our culture. They must equip their children with the moral compass that will guide them through life as a member of the porn generation. And strong young men and women must be prepared to stand up to the cultural intimidation and peer pressure of an oversexed society. By rebuilding a culture founded on strong moral standards, we can heal the porn generation from within. ultimately, our generation will not be led by the oversexed pop stars, the sex educators, the celebrities, or the blind followers of Live and Let Live. It will be led by those brave enough and dedicated enough to climb their way out of the morass, to return our country to the ultimate truth of its moral heritage, to a place that honors and cherishes all that once was good and can be again. Solving the problem. Laws and regulations cannot, by themselves, stem the tide of societal amorality. When a society is absolutely determined to poison itself, mere legislation cannot stop it. So the first job is to raise the level of personal adherence to traditional morality. Parents must teach their children traditional standards, and they must live by those same standards themselves. Sometimes this means turning off the television, throwing out the CDs and DVDs, and canceling subscriptions to teen magazines. Sometimes it just means talking to your kids. But this isn't enough. Libertarians and social liberals would have us believe that as long as those of us who adhere to traditional morality do so, we should allow opponents of traditional morality to live life their way, without consequences. This ignores the fact that these actions are social, not individual. The direction of our culture has ramifications for society. Tolerance of all behavior leads to societal immorality, and societal approval of immoral personal behavior has vast externalities. Just as a manufacturing plant that produces toxic waste may affect others by poisoning a river, so too may the immoral among us affect others by poisoning the culture. This means that we should not hesitate to move forward in protecting our culture collectively. Here, then, are some collective, practical solutions we should enact in order to protect our culture from further anti-traditional assault. Abstinence-only education. We must tell our elected representatives to make abstinence-only education the primary course across America. We know that the comprehensive sex education has failed miserably in curbing teen sexual voraciousness. It's time to try a path that actually values chastity. Faith-based initiatives. We must adopt faith-based community initiatives to revitalize traditional values among students. Abstinence-only education can only be truly successful in the context of a full set of values taught by parents and religious communities. Thankfully, the Bush administration is dedicated to slowing the indoctrination of children into the lifestyle of sexual permissiveness and moral relativism. This goal is well within reach. School vouchers. It's time to take our schools back. We can do this by pushing for school vouchers, allowing parents to make informed decisions about the values they wish schools to teach to their children. Competitive pressure can only help move public schools away from teaching amorality. Dress codes. Public schools should begin, and have begun, instituting dress codes. Permissiveness in dress is an early and important step toward permissiveness in values. Single-sex dorms, or living at home for college students. In higher education, parents should demand that their children live in single-sex dorms, or at least in dorms with single-sex bathrooms, or get apartments. Sending young adults to local universities is also a good move. At 18, teenagers aren't ready to face the pressures they will encounter at a college hundreds of miles from home. Even religious teenagers may be converted by the temptations they see on university campuses and the ridicule they encounter there. Monitoring alumni funding for universities. Alumni and donors should consider directing their funding to universities where traditional values are still part of the curriculum. In my first book, Brainwashed, How Universities Indoctrinate America's Youth, I advocate what I call startup universities. Conservatives should begin a movement to open politically balanced universities. Competition is the ultimate equalizer. Using the Federal Communications Commission. The Federal Communications Commission has some authority to control obscenity and indecency. The FCC requires written complaints from viewers in order to invoke its powers. To that end, here is the contact information for the FCC. FCC Enforcement Bureau, Investigations and Hearings Division, 445 12th Street, Southwest, Washington, D.C.